Okay, it's time to get started with buns. Boring, stodgy, reliable buns. And what I first should tell you is that the book, in an effort to be a rigorous college textbook, has far too much information devoted to bonds. We're going to take a little bit from chapter 9, and then a little bit from chapter 18, and a little bit from chapter 19, and a little bit from chapter 20, and some lecture notes. And as you read through these chapters, if you find yourself starting to fall asleep, which you may do, go back and make sure you understand what's in the presentation. Okay? Is that a deal? All right. Yeah. Because bonds are, well, okay. Let's say it. Bonds are boring. They're, but, you know, they're not as fun as stocks, but we got to know about them, folks. Because as Andrew Carnegie said many, many years ago, the steel industrialist, gentlemen prefer bonds. And that's before the movie Gentlemen Prefer Blondes? Yeah, right. Okay. Slide number 2. What are bonds? Well, we've discussed these many times, right? They're negotiable, publicly traded, long-term debt securities. You're buying a loan, folks, whereby the issuer agrees to pay a fixed amount of interest over a specified period of time and to repay a fixed amount of principal at maturity. Hence, we often refer to bonds as fixed income securities, debt financing. A bond is really just an IOU issued by a corporation. Those are corporate bonds. A state or local municipality. Those are municipal bonds. The federal government, treasury bonds. And we don't have this in the slide, but also foreign governments and foreign companies issue bonds also. The bondholder loans money to the bond issuer. Bonds are loans. Investors who buy bonds are loaners. Instead of owners, when you buy stocks, you're part owner of the corporation, right? Exactly. So you get to play the part of the bank. You get to lend your money to corporations or municipalities, state and local governments, bridge authorities, school districts, water authorities, the cities, exactly. And you get paid just as when you go to a bank, you pay interest to the bank when they lend you money. The entities here, the federal government, they pay you interest. And you know how much that interest is, hence we call it fixed. Slide number 3, the trust indenture. You can think of it like the mortgage contract that you, mortgage documents that you sign when you borrow money to buy a house. It's a contract that sets forth the terms between the issuer and the bondholders. It describes the bondholder's rights and the issuer's obligation. The indenture appoints a trustee, someone to oversee that the obligations are carried out. The trustee is a commercial bank or a company called a trust company whose job it is to make sure that everything is done according to the covenants, according to the provisions of the trust indenture. And there are protective covenants to make sure that the bond issuers do what they say they're going to do. Keep the business in keep good working order, to keep equipment, make payments on time. An example are the bonds that Southwestern sold, the Proposition R bonds. There's a trustee that makes sure we do what we say we're going to do with those bonds. We say we're going to rebuild, fix up some of the campus, and build out the corner lot on H Street and Otay Lakes Road. And I don't know if you've been following the news about what's been going on, but it hasn't been pretty. So we'll see what happens. Slide number 4. Why invest in bonds? Well, Bondholders receive interest, a fixed amount of interest during the life of the bond, normally paid every 6 months. Virtually all bonds pay every 6 months. Some pay quarterly or manually or monthly, but no, virtually all bonds pay every 6 months. And the principal is returned when the bond is redeemed. The typical bond maturity is from 1 to 30 years. Those are the two big reasons. You buy bonds, you invest in bonds mostly for the interest and the fact that they're going to pay you the money back. Now, there is a third reason that you could buy bonds, because there is a potential for a capital gain or a capital loss. If interest rates fall, there is a potential for a capital gain, but there's also a potential for capital loss if interest rates rise. Now, we're going to discuss this in detail, folks, and you will understand this by the end of your study of bonds, because it's the one thing that tends to drive people nuts. But if you intend to hold the bonds until maturity, when you are paid the money back that you lent the bond issuers, you do not care about capital gains or losses. You don't care because you're going to get your money back that you lent them. Some bonds do offer tax advantages, and we'll discuss the tax advantages of municipal bonds and treasury bonds. And then some bonds can be converted into stocks. Those are called convertible bonds. Sounds kind of sexy, huh? Yeah, well, it's an attempt. It's an attempt to throw a little pizzazz into bonds, but it doesn't really turn out that great, as we'll see. We'll deal with convertibles and other hybrid securities at a later time. Slide number 5. Why should you invest in bonds? Well, they do have some advantages over stocks. Bondholders are first in line for repayment if there's ever default on the loans. Well, that's not actually true. The tax man come first, and then payroll expenses, the salaries of the people who work for the company. But who's at the back of the line? Right, stockholders are at the back of the line. That's why in a major bankruptcy, the bondholders usually get something. Maybe not everything that they originally invested, but stockholders, right, stockholders usually don't get anything because the carcass of the corporation has already been picked over by all the bondholders. Bond prices are far less volatile than stocks. We saw that stocks are very volatile, but bond prices still fluctuate. Bond prices can go up and down, and do go up and down. And they go down when interest rates rise. Again, we'll discuss this later on. It's an inverse relationship. Interest rates go up, bond prices go down. Interest rates go down, bond prices go up. The average return over decades has been 4, 5, 6% for muni bonds, treasury bonds, 6, 7, 8% for corporate bonds. Some corporate bonds pay a whole lot higher. But these are the returns over decades. Right now, bonds are paying less than their historical norms, especially treasury bonds. But some are paying more. When a bond issuer has to pay a high interest rate, right, exactly. That means their credit's not that great, just as a person might have to pay more for a credit card or a car loan or a home loan. If they don't have very good credit rating, same thing is true for bond issuers. I'm sorry, not the investors, but the corporations, the state and local municipalities, or the federal government. Slide number 6. By far, the most misunderstood feature about bonds is their inverse relationship with interest rates. And it's a seesaw, a sube y baja, up and down. When interest rates fall, bond prices rise. And when interest rates rise, bond prices fall. Drives people nuts. Even people who've been in the industry for a long time. You've got to stop and think about it because it will catch you. And you got to understand it, folks. We will discuss it in detail. And why is this? It doesn't make any sense, huh? I'm sorry, we'll go back to that in a bit. Did I hit the right button? I think I did. Right, we'll come back to this bonds and interest rates in detail later on, but just remember that and we'll come back to it again. Slide number 7. Bonds versus stocks. Over the long term, huh? Stocks have outperformed bonds. Okay, so why invest in bonds, right? If we've seen that stocks are over the long term have been a better investment than bonds, well, stocks are more volatile. Stocks carry more risk. Bonds offer an element of stability to your portfolio. Some people call it ballast. If you know anything about ships and sailing, you know that ballast is what they put in the bottom of the ship to keep it from tilting over. Some people call it ballast. And it helps you during those times when the market's falling to see that, you know, it's not as bad as it could be, because, you know, bonds actually sometimes go up when stocks go down. And in 2008, they went down. Everybody went down, but they didn't go down anywhere near as much as the stock portion of your portfolio. So it's an element of stability. And then for some investors, stocks are simply too risky. They reason, say, they look, hey, if I can obtain my long-term goals without taking on the risk of being invested in stocks, so be it. I'll be happy with my 5-6%. I can sleep better at night. I can sleep better at night factor, we call it. Bonds also make good intermediate term investments, where stocks are good long term investments, and some stocks are good intermediate term, but mostly stocks are for the long term. And sometimes, folks, bonds are just screaming good deals, in which case, hey, let's put some money into them. Slide number 8. What are the risks? Remember, there's always risks no matter what investment we put our money into. Interest rate risks. Interest rates fall, bond prices rise. When interest rates rise, bond prices fall. So you got to be careful. If you intend to sell the bonds in the future, a rise in interest rates can translate into capital losses. But as we'll see, if you just want the bonds for the interest, which is what a lot of people do, they're just interested in the income. You don't care about interest rate risk. Purchasing power risk. Well, this is the bondholder's nightmare. Say inflation starts to kick up. There's a risk that your purchasing power will fall if inflation outstrips your return from the bonds. And then there's the business financial risk. This is the risk that the bond issuer will default, meaning they won't be able to make their interest rate payments and their principal payments. This is much less a risk with municipals and treasury bonds, and it's really not that a risk with most corporate bonds. Most people pay their credit card bills and their car loans and their mortgage payments during normal times, right? Have these been normal times the last few years? Nothing close to normal times. So yeah, a lot of people have defaulted on their credit cards and their car loans and their home loans, and not as many as one would think, but there have been some spectacular defaults corporate loans, corporate bonds, such as Lehman Brothers, that you might remember. And munis, some munis have gone belly up in the past, but it's very rare. The Treasury, folks, I don't care what anybody says, the United States Treasury can and will make its debts. We have some serious issues confronting us with regard to debt, but the United States government will be able to pay its debts. Slide number 9, continuing the risks. There's liquidity risk. This means that there's not enough buyers out there when and if an investor wants to sell their bonds. Well, it's less of a problem with treasuries and munis. It can be a big problem with thinly traded bonds. And why is there not as much liquidity? Well, because most people buy their bonds for the interest. They don't buy to trade them. They buy to hang on to them and get their income. So there's not as big a turnover as there can be in stocks. So that's a problem if you need to sell your bonds. And then the call risk. We'll discuss the call feature, the prepayment risk, the prepayment feature. We'll discuss that in detail. There's a risk that a bond will be called away from the investor before its scheduled maturity date. And this is much like a home mortgage can be refinanced. So if you're getting this great interest rate and you're really happy and all of a sudden interest rates fall, there's a real chance that your bond issuer, the corporation or the municipality, will call in the bonds and say, oh, you know, we can get a better interest rate, so we'll pay you off. Treasuries have never been callable, and some bonds are non-callable. We'll discuss this in detail. Slide number 10, bond interest and principal. Am I going too fast? You see, that's what you can do in the face-to-face class. You can't do that online. I don't know if I'm going too fast, but you can always hit the pause button, go back over it, right? The coupon rate, what a silly name. This is the feature of a bond that defines the amount of the annual interest. It's also called the nominal rate, meaning named rate, the coupon yield, the nominal yield. On most all bonds, as we said, the interest is usually paid every 6 months, although a few pay month to month, quarterly, once a year. Now, where did this term coupon rate come from, huh? Well, it's something you should know because people will use that and they'll expect you to understand it. But it's an obsolete term. The term coupon rate came from the fact that bonds used to have coupons attached to them. Literally, the bond was a document with all these little coupons, and you would cut the coupon, clip the coupon, and send it in. When the interest was due, an investor was required to send the coupon into the bond issuer, and the bond issuer would then turn around and send them a check. Why? It sounds like a silly way of... No, it actually was very common and very useful because that way I could sell the bond to somebody else and then they would send in the coupon and say, okay, pay me the interest. You see, it's all electronic now, folks. Don't worry about this. But to this day, earning interest from a bond is often called clipping the coupon, even though now virtually all transactions are done electronically. So remember that. You coupon clippers out there. slide number 11, the principal. This is the amount of capital that must be paid at maturity. The amount of the loan, the par value, the face value. The principal of most bonds is $1,000. Bonds are denominated almost always in $1,000 increments. Some people in the industry call them pieces, $1,000 pieces. There are some that are $5,000 and $10,000, but we will, in this class, we will always refer to the face value, the par value, the maturity value as $1,000. Now, putting the coupon rate and the principal together tells you how much interest you will receive each year. So, for example, a coupon rate of 7% and a principal of $1,000 gives $70 of interest each year. Do you have that down? I mean, that's not that hard. Try it on your calculator. $1,000 times 7%, $1,000 times 8% or 6%. So since almost all bonds are denominated in $1,000 increments, knowing the coupon rate gives you the amount of interest. Therefore, normally bond investors simply refer to the bonds by the coupon rate and their maturity. I bought a 7% 30-year bond. So that person who heard that says, oh, okay, this guy's going to get $70 a year, actually $35 twice a year, for the next 30 years. You got it? Yeah, it's not that hard. Slide number 12. The maturity date is the date on which a bond matures and the principal must be repaid. Term bonds mature all at once. They are the most common types of bonds. For example, a company will issue 20-year bonds that all mature in 20 years on the same date. Interesting. Now, there are other types of bonds called serial bonds, and they have series of maturities. For example, a company may issue series of 20-year serial bonds with 20 maturity dates, each series maturing each year for 20 years, or some of them mature in 5 and 10 and 15 years. So each year or each 5 years or whatever, a certain portion of the issue would come due and be paid off. That series would mature. So you might be getting the feeling that these things are not really like a mortgage, are they? No, they're not. In a mortgage, you pay every month some of your principal and some of your interest. With bonds, you normally pay, well, actually, you don't make the bonds, you invest in the bonds. The company, the corporation, or the municipality, or the federal government pays interest and doesn't pay back the principal until the bond matures. Unless it's a serial bond, in which case they mature in series, and that's how they pay it off. Interesting. Slide number 13. Bonds versus notes. These are one of those things that you just wish would go away, but you gotta know it. Technically, there is a difference between a bond and a note. Notes mature in 2 to 10 years. Bonds mature in 10 or more years, usually 20 to 30 years. Some bonds mature in 50 or 100 years. Yeah, railroads and other big industries of the late 19th century and early 20th century had these bonds that matured in 100 years. And a very small number of bonds never mature. They are called perpetuities or consols. And this drives me nuts. So people say, the 10-year bond is paying 2%. They'll say, oh, no, it's not the 10-year bond. It's the 10-year note, the 5-year note. And I just say, in practice, many investors, including myself, use the term bond to refer to both bonds and notes. So there, you sticklers for perfection. So you'll hear people say the 5-year bond, the 5-year note, and you know that it really is the note, but don't worry about it because people like me are going to still call it a bond. Slide number 14, the call provision. The call provision is the provision that specifies whether and under what circumstances the issuer can retire or prepay the bond prior to the maturity date. So if you're a homeowner and you're paying 7, 8% on your loan, wouldn't you love to get a 4 or 5% home loan? Yes, you would refinance. And the same thing is true for the bond issuers. If interest rates drop, just as a homeowner would want to refinance their mortgage, a bond issuer would want to refinance their bond loans. So the issuer calls in the bonds. Here, bonds. Come here, bonds. You hear what they call? Yeah. The bonds are called away from the bond investor. It's also called prepaying the bonds, prepayment of bonds. And all other factors being equal, and of course they never are, what would you rather have? Would you rather have non-callable bonds or callable bonds? Right, you would prefer non-callable bonds. And for that reason, often non-callable bonds will, all other things being equal, pay less than callable bonds. Yeah, that makes sense. Because you don't want your bonds called away if interest rates go down. You want to keep clipping your coupon at a higher rate. Slide number 15. There are three types of call provisions. Freely callable, which means they can be retired at any time. They can be called at any time. Non-callable, the issuer is prohibited from retiring the bond before the maturity date. They have to continue to make that payment. And then what is common with corporate and municipal bonds are deferred call periods, call protection periods, call deferment periods. The issuer must wait for a certain length of time, typically 5-10 years, to pass before the bonds can be called away. And as it says at the bottom, most corporate and municipal bonds are freely callable or they have the deferred call period. Treasuries from the United States government have never been callable. That doesn't mean they won't issue them in the future, but they just never have been callable. Which of the above provisions is least desirable? Well, certainly freely callable. What's the most desirable? Non-callable. And, of course, deferred call is somewhere in between. So you understand that? Okay. It's like refinancing your home loan. Slide 16. Often there is a call premium, the amount that is added to a bond's par value and paid to investors when a bond is retired prematurely. So, for example, there might be an $85 premium. You can think of it like the prepayment penalty of a home mortgage. Some home mortgages say, sure, you can pay us off before the loan is due, but we're going to hit you with a 1% or whatever premium. We're going to hit you with a prepayment penalty. And this is true of bonds. So the call price is very simple. You just add that $1,000 to the premium. You add the par value, the price the issuer must pay to retire a bond prematurely. So if we had the $1,000 par and an $85 premium, then the issuer, the corporation and municipality, would have to pay the bond investor $1,085 to retire the bond. If there is no call premium, this bond is said to be callable at par, which means all they have to do is give you your $1,000 and they take the loan away from you. And then what do you have to do? Right, just like the bank or credit union that you refinanced the loan with, the mortgage with, they've got to go take that money, and you have to go take that money and go out there and get another bond, and what you're going to get much less interest, right, because they called that one away from you. Slide number 17, principles of bond price behavior. Okay, here's where we get back to this idea of bond selling for more than the $1,000 or less than the $1,000, more than par or greater than par. And we have two different types. Premium, a bond with a market value greater than the par value. Now, when does this occur? Well, interest rates have dropped. This occurs when prevailing interest rates drop, because if interest rates go down, what happens to bond prices? Remember the seesaw. And the discount bond is the other side of the coin. It's a bond with a market value lower than the par value. This occurs when prevailing interest rates are greater than the coupon rate. So interest rates have gone up and your bond price has gone down. Now, it also occurs when and if the investment community believes that the bond issuer is in danger of defaulting on interest payments or principal payments. And we'll see that with these Ford bonds that we kept track of since the financial crisis 2008-2009. If there is no premium nor there is no discount, the bond is said to be selling at par. So it's selling for $1,000. Slide number 18. Wait a minute, you're going to ask me, why would a bond sell at a premium or a discount to its par value? If you made the loan for $1,000, wouldn't the loan always sell for $1,000? Right? Doesn't that make... Yeah, it's a little bit tricky, folks. No, the answer is no. No, no, no. Since the interest rate of your bond doesn't change, what does change? The price. Remember, bonds are fixed. Their interest is fixed. The income is fixed. But the price of the bond changes to reflect the change in the prevailing interest rates within the financial industry. Do you remember the image of the seesaw? Keep it in your mind when you think about this. The interest rate has gone down, my bond is worth more. Interest rate's gone up, oh, my bond is worth less. And let's see how that works in practice. Slide number 19. Let's say you have a bond that's paying 10%. The bond's face value is $1,000. That means you're getting $100 a year. 10% of $1,000 is $100. You understand? That's pretty straightforward, isn't it, right? If you have a bond for $1,000 and it's paying 10%, well, do that on your calculator. 10% times, or 1.1 times 1,000, and you get $100. Well, actually, you get $50 twice a year. Now, what happens if interest rates fall to 8%? Investors are only going to get $80 for a $1,000 bond, right? They're not going to get $100 as you are getting. So they would have to actually pay $1,250 to get the same amount of interest. They'd have to pay $1,250 times 8%. That would give them $100. Well, you know, they're going to get a bond at $1,000. The result is your bond is now worth more than it was worth when you bought it. Why? Because you're not going to sell your $1,000 bond for $1,000 when it's paying $100 in interest, and new $1,000 bonds are only paying $80, you're going to say, oh no, give me more, I want more. Now, are you going to get the full $1,250? not quite. It doesn't work exactly that way. Because what happens when the bond matures? Right. Whoever has the bond when it's matured is only going to get $1,000. They're not going to get that premium. But right now, especially if your bond is a long-term bond, your bond is worth more than what it was. It would be sold at a premium. You'd have a capital gain if it were sold. The same thing applies when interest rates rise. A discount bond, slide number 20. Let's say the bond is paying 10%. The bond's face value is 1,000, and so you're getting 1,000 times 0.1 times 10%, or $100, $50 twice a year. And say interest rates rise to 12%. Well, you see, they're going to get more than $100 from new bonds. They're going to get $120. They would only have to pay $833 to get the same amount of interest. So they're not going to pay you $1,000. They're going to demand a discount. So if you were to sell your bond, you would sell it now for less than it was worth before this happened, before the interest rates rose. So you would sell this at a discount. It would be a discount bond. Now, are you required to sell it? Do you? No. No one can force you to sell it. You can hang on to your bond and continue to receive the $100 a year until the bond matures, and then you get your money back. But if you were forced to sell it, or if that was your plan, if that were your plan, then you would have to take a loss. You'd have to take a capital loss and sell it for less than what you paid for it. Slide 21. Continuing this idea, the amount of the premium or discount is not only related to the amount of the fall or rise of interest rates. In general, the greater the fall or rise in interest rates, the greater the premium or discount. But the maturity date is also very important. In general, the longer the maturity, the greater the premium or discount. In other words, how much longer do you get to take advantage of the fact that your bond is paying more interest at a premium or paying less interest at a discount? So the image of the seesaw is very good in this respect. Do you remember playing on the seesaw when you were a kid? Maybe you play with a seesaw now. And if you were at the way at the end and the other guy or gal jumped off, you went way up in the air. Excuse me if I yelled into the microphone. And if they jumped on it, you went whoa down. If they jumped off, you went way down. And this is what happens. If you're in the middle, if you're standing in the middle and the seesaw goes way up and down, you just move a little bit. And that's why, folks, that's why we often refer to long-term bonds as much riskier than short-term bonds, because they are affected much more by swings, either up or down, in the interest rates. So just like the seesaw, the farther out you are, the greater the rise or the greater the fall, and that is why long-term bonds are riskier than short-term bonds. So here's a graph from the sixth edition. That is kind of useful, but it's actually not the best quality. But this is the idea. You see, if we are, let's get the magic cursor here, way over here, and we have 30 years until the bond matures, well, then a rise in interest rates is really going to drop our bond, or a drop in interest rates is going to really rise our bond. And as we get closer and closer and closer and closer to the day that the bond matures, well, what are you going to get back when the bond matures? Right, you're going to get back $1,000 when the bond matures. So as it gets closer and closer to maturity date, the bond's discount or premium gets smaller and smaller and smaller until finally they all converge at $1,000. Make sense? Yeah, I think it does. It's a little tricky. Yes, it is. But go back and make sure you get it right, because I can assure you that it'll trip you up every from time to time, because it trips people in the industry who've been in the industry for a long time. Slide number 23. In general, long-term bonds exhibit greater price volatility and a greater opportunity for capital gain or loss. Intermediate-term and short-term bonds exhibit lesser price volatility and, of course, a lesser opportunity for capital gains or loss. Bonds very close to maturity, folks, start to act very similarly to short-term investments such as money markets. They start to look like corporate paper and treasury bills. Why? Because they're going to mature in 6 or 9 months or something like that. So doesn't that sound familiar? Right. They start to look like short-term securities. However, if you intend to keep the bonds until they mature, then you are not concerned about the price volatility. That doesn't matter to you. You will always receive the par value of the bond, except in the rare case of the bond default. I mean, if that happens, then all bets are off. You could, you know, that doesn't happen often, but it does happen. GM, Kmart, Enron. So you understand private bond price behavior. You better understand it, because I'm going to ask you several times on the exam, because I don't want you to go out there and look silly. And yeah, okay. So go back and take a look at that in detail. Okay, so let's end this first presentation of our introduction to bonds by looking at the history of bond yields versus the yield on stock dividends. And this slide should look familiar, right? We saw this slide back in our introduction to stocks. And we saw that starting around 1960, when this graphic started, they were fairly close to one another. Bonds were paying a little over 4%. Stocks were paying dividends a little less than 4%. And then they started to diverge. As inflation started to take hold in the 1970s, the baby boomer generation came of age, the oil crises, Vietnam War, inflation started to take hold and bond yields started to go up. Also, what happened in the 1970s is the yield on stocks, the dividend yield, started to go up. Why? Because the price of stocks really fell hard in the 70s. And then Jimmy Carter, yes, we did have a president by the name of Jimmy, nominated Paul Volcker as the Federal Reserve Chairman, Federal Reserve Bank Chairman, and said, can you do something about this inflation? And he said, yes, but it'll probably cost you your presidency. And it was one of the contributing factors to him losing in 1980. He raised short-term interest rates to, I think, at one time, 22%, the prime rate hit 22%, and bond yields skyrocketed. This is the 10-year Treasury note, and we see it hit 15% there for a period. And many of you weren't alive, but mortgage rates hit 16, 17% just for a couple of months, and then what we saw is the stock market starting to react, and the bond market starting to react as inflation started to come down quickly, because Mr. Volcker was successful in breaking the back of inflation. And his predecessor, Alan Greenspan, continued that inflation hawk stance. And we had what he called, Alan Greenspan, the Great Moderation. We saw bond yields coming down quite a bit, keep it coming down. If you were refinancing your mortgage, it was a great time for you to have an adjustable rate mortgage, or some people refinanced every couple of years because interest rates kept falling and falling. And we saw the yield on stocks falling and falling and falling. Why? Well, because stocks were doing really well throughout the 1980s and 1990s, and so people were bidding up the price relative to the dividend. Until finally in the year 2000, at the height of the stock market bubble, dividends went to 1% on the Standard & Poor's 500. Very, very low. And bond yields kept falling and falling and falling until we had the 2008 crash and turmoil. And we see that bond yields plummeted. Well, that was the 10-year Treasury note, folks. People wanted nothing to do with stocks, nothing to do with real estate, nothing to do with derivatives, nothing to do with commodities, nothing to do with bonds unless they were treasury bonds. And so the yield plummeted as the price went up. At the same time, stocks going down, the dividend on yield of the Standard & Poor's 500 went above the interest rate yield on bonds. And that during history has often been a great time to buy stocks, and of course it turned out to be an excellent time to buy stocks. And bonds came back a little bit as people thought that the world